by appellant, if you so choose to take that time. When you approach the podium, please pronounce your name and your client's name, and let us know how you'd like us to refer to both you and your client during the argument this morning. You can use either the microphone and the podium that is located right next to you, or you can use the middle one. The middle one does have the timer, so you can see how much time you have left, and then it also has a button just underneath in the center part to raise and lower the podium for your liking. The normal rules of decorum for the court are in place, as always. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may approach the podium and state your name for the record, the party you're representing, and you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Roll, and I am representing State Farm Insurance Company. So, at issue in this case, this case started out as a no-fault benefit claim. Mr. Gillespie here was representing an individual that was not insured, not a named insured of State Farm. And that individual was involved in an accident, and Mr. Gillespie filed a no-fault arbitration petition on behalf of his client. And at the time, State Farm had received an affidavit of no insurance only 9 days prior to the filing of that no-fault petition. And so the claim hadn't been denied. State Farm requested...
Roll.
Yes, sir.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I know your time is valuable and short. And I was hoping you could address, first off, the issue, assuming that 65B, the statutory argument, is... Put that aside. Put it in brackets over here. We're only looking at the potential issues of fact on 481.13. Why is the affidavit, I understand you're arguing it's untimely, but assume we don't agree with that. Assume we say it is timely. Why is the affidavit not enough for the court to conclude that resolves all factual issues, or no reasonable juror could find a genuine issue of fact under that part of it?
Sure. So this matter has been before the Court of Appeals previously, and the holding from the Court of Appeals was that issues of fact exist that preclude summary judgment. And following that decision, plaintiff in the lawsuit filed a summary judgment motion and attached two affidavits saying that that clarified the issues of material fact. First of all, defendant requested to take the plaintiff's deposition and conduct formal discovery.
Again, let's just assume that I'm disagreeing with whatever process arguments that you have about timeliness or not being able to depose. That I'm just asking, does the affidavit alone, just looking at that, does that resolve the factual question of the scope of their agreement? Or do you think that even looking at that affidavit, you still would have a question of fact because that affidavit doesn't say it exactly in the right way and you're still not clear? Or do you think that affidavit, if we get to it, that's where I'm going?
Sure, and I guess my position is that the affidavit is more or less not determinative of the material fact issues because the issue is whether or not number one fact issue for the jury, in my opinion, would be whether or not there was a constructive denial of the no-fault claim, because there was no express denial, and if there was no constructive denial, that would preclude an attorney from having priority over the medical provider as far as the payment goes, and that's based off of 65.
Mr. Rolkin, didn't you just unbracket the 65B that Judge Bryan asked you to bracket?
It may have been unfair to bracket. I don't know if it's so intertwined that you can't. So with that,
well, that's how I was kind of separating it myself. And I honestly, when I look at the record, it was presented in multiple times as kind of a blended issue to the district court, which is why I don't specifically blame the district court for not addressing 65B, but don't you see that as a wall between these two? In other words, before you get to the issue of whether one has a valid attorney's lien, you'd have to answer the question under 65B.57, which on its face precludes such a lien unless it's been denied. Am I correct?
You are correct in thinking that way. The reason, and I apologize for the way that the brief was originally argued, but what it did was it was addressing the attorney lien statute at issue. And the first line of the attorney lien statute deals with the commencement of an arbitration. And so that's what I argued first. And the reasoning behind that, again, is because if no lien was ever commenced, then the priority wouldn't matter. And so I argued to the district court that there was never a lien. And then if there was a lien, it was the other lien, the chiropractor's lien had priority over that lien. And we never got to that second issue.
But to never be a lien, again, you're right, you're putting the brackets again around 65B, just looking to getting to Judge Bryan's question, what part of the affidavit itself, based on our remand instruction, is missing such that there would be no attorney's lien pursuant to 481? Or to say another way, what would be the fact issue, just looking at that alone, that a fact finder would need to make other than what's in those affidavits?
Well, the fact issue is, I guess there isn't one, Your Honor.
So you're conceding that if we were separating 65B.57 from our discussion and just looking at the attorney's lien statute, the court was correct. There is no genuine issue of material fact, but that they have a valid lien.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to throw you off into that part of the argument. I do think it's important to try to determine the remand and whether there was anything about this court's previous opinion that precludes the district court from considering this other statutory, I'll call it a defense, right, or the 65B priority list statute for economic loss benefits. And I think your argument is that there isn't something that would have precluded the district court. It was raised before the district court, before the first appeal, and raised again on remand. And if I'm mistaking that argument, please let me know. But if I'm not, then why don't you give us your quick 10-15 second reason as to why you don't think our previous opinion precludes the district court from considering that statutory defense or the statutory sequence of priority.
Could you repeat that, Your Honor? Sorry about that.
Why do you think that the district court could consider 65B after our remand instructions? Or why does our previous opinion not preclude that?
Well, because the appeal submitted by the plaintiff or the appellant at the time addressed a very narrow specific issue of whether or not an arbitration commenced. And so because a decision hadn't been made by the district court regarding the second issue of whether the priority of the lien, I didn't think it was ripe for argument at the appellate level. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
And so, Mr. Roll, would it be a fair summary to say that the issue, if we call it a defense or if we call it a subsequent statutory exception to the attorney's lien statute, that whether 65B.57 precludes a lien here is a legal question?
I think that it's a question of fact in the sense that question is determinative on whether or not there was a denial by the insurance company. and there wasn't an express denial. So whether or not there was a constructive denial is kind of the issue there. Well, it is the issue there. And if you look at...
Let me ask it a different way. And the part of the reason I ask is I could tell the parties were struggling to find what kind of jury instruction the judge asked for proposed verdict form and jury instructions. And I think the reason the court was struggling is trying to find some fact issue. And so do you believe in the record before the district court? I know your client didn't bring a motion for summary judgment, but were there any genuine issues of material fact to suggest that there had been a rejected claim?
Well, the only one would be that a petition was filed for no-fault arbitration, which is supposed to not happen unless a claim has been denied. I don't think that the plaintiff in this matter has provided any evidence on its own behalf to suggest that the claim was denied. I haven't seen any evidence on that issue, and that's kind of been the basis of my argument is they have the burden of proof, and they never proved or they never even argued that the claim was denied. Can I proceed to the second issue? Getting on with kind of where we left off is this affidavit then comes and the defense hasn't had an opportunity to cross this lady to prove, to even confirm that she lives. She wasn't disclosed in any discovery responses as a witness or any other, in any other manner. And then all of a sudden, after the Court of Appeals, you know, holds that an issue of, you know, fact exists, then there's just a motion for summary judgment filed right again, fulfilled by the affidavit. I think that a jury should be able to evaluate the credibility of the witness. She completed this affidavit more than 3 years after she had an apparent discussion with Mr. Gillespie about the scope of their representation. It's unclear how much she remembers, and the text of the affidavit indicates that it was drafted, you know, by her counsel and using third party pronouns to refer to her. And I think a jury should. I think that my client's entitled to have a jury evaluate her credibility and what she recalls, you know, as best evidence.
It seems like part of the argument is that it was premature to accept this affidavit without any additional discovery and without giving the opportunity for you to even respond in a way when the district court kind of changes course there right before trial. But I don't know that that's specifically asserted as an error. Can you show me where in your brief you're arguing that it was error for the court to it was premature for the court to just rely on the affidavit in the absence of a deposition?
Sure. So under the second heading there, we have case law from Hebrink, which indicates that when a party brings a motion for summary judgment or a motion disguised as summary judgment, the defendant has a minimum of 28 days to be heard, or to prepare to be heard. In this matter, I was given 48 hours after begging the judge to allow me to at least submit a written response. I mean, her argument.
Right. I see that. What about the discovery piece? This. Not being able to do a deposition.
Well, again, what would you like to know about that?
No, I'm asking where in the brief are you asserting error in the district court's handling of and changing course, and that it deprived you of doing discovery that would be necessary to determine whether there's a fact issue at summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, I couldn't find any case law where a court had ever denied a defendant a right to take the plaintiff's deposition. And so I don't have specific case law on that, but being that I more or less wasn't allowed to conduct any type of discovery other than the deposition of the third-party defendant, you know, I think that's a big reason why some of these arguments didn't get a chance to fully develop. This isn't a matter that was tried or anything like that. It was just, it basically went right into summary judgment, and that was granted in favor of my client.
And Mr. Brewer, just to clarify the timing, though, there was two summary judgment hearings, as it turns out, right? And so, in effect, one was more of a telephone conference with a short briefing period, the order that we are now reviewing. But many months earlier, and not long after the remand, the Gillespie firm filed its notice of motion and summary judgment, and the full 28 days in the notice and the affidavit, all was the usual procedure was followed, correct?
Well,
leading up to that hearing and that court's order, which denied summary judgment initially.
I believe that's true, Your Honor.
So just to clarify, there was no new evidence presented, and maybe this goes to Judge Bryan's case, there was no new evidence about 6 or 7 months later when the judge in a phone call informed the parties that she was reconsidering the earlier denial.
That's correct. There was no new evidence. My understanding is that, well, at least what the judge communicated to me during the phone call was she was preparing for trial with her clerk. She had her clerk looking over the case, and her clerk brought up the fact that she felt that there wasn't an issue of material fact any longer because of the affidavits, and so she agreed, and she was going to rule that way.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. Should be under the center part there.
Oh, right here. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
You bet.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, there's little arrows for me. You're a short, fat guy. You need to move it down some. Good morning, Your Honor. Patrick R. Gillespie on behalf of the Gillespie Law Firm. I'm going to call ourselves the law firm in this argument, and I'll probably refer to the appellant as both State Farm and the insurer. There are really two issues that has been briefed by State Farm here in this matter. First issue is whether they were given adequate opportunity to defend a summary judgment motion. And secondly, whether this court should take on an issue that was not addressed by the district court on appeal for the first time.
And counsel, you're referring to the Minnesota statute 65B.57,
yes.
And why shouldn't we address that?
Because that issue was never even briefed before the district court. You're looking at attempting
Was it raised before the district court, though? Didn't State Farm raise that issue before the district court, but the district court just never considered it?
It was raised initially before the first appeal, but was never decided by a district court. State Farm didn't file any kind of request to the district court to resolve the issue, nor did it file a cross appeal asking for affirmation of the district court's prior order that was reversed later on alternative grounds. And that would have been the appropriate way to preserve the issue.
I was just going to say that we noted in our prior opinion that this issue had not been discussed or decided by the district court, so we specifically did not address the applicability of the statute.
I don't wish to disagree with the court, but the prior opinion says it wasn't briefed or raised by the parties. It doesn't say the district court doesn't say anything about the district court's action.
Well, it says neither party cites or briefs the applicability
correct.
Of the statute. So that seems to leave the door open for it to be raised to and addressed by the district court.
Well, the district court ruled that the State Farm had waived the right by not raising it in the first appeal, Your Honor, because State Farm vigorously contended that they did raise the issue before the district court in the first motion.
So, Mr. Gillespie, is it your argument that the district court found waiver or forfeiture, or is your argument that that footnote we've been talking about closed the door, an act of this court closed the door, or is it a failure to act on behalf of State Farm that prohibited them from being able to raise the issue?
The latter, Your Honor.
So are you conceding then that the footnote from this court's previous opinion is not shutting the door?
I'm conceding, Your Honor, that the door was never opened by State Farm to argue it later, and so for
all
this.
Right, so I don't really understand the analogy I brought up anymore. Sorry. Is there something in our court's previous order that precludes State Farm from raising 65B on remand?
Nothing specific, Your Honor. However, State Farm's failure to bring the issue to the court last time we were here is a waiver on their part.
So if I then let's talk about that, because I think I understand the argument now more. I'm not so convinced that a party who is the respondent, because the appellant is the aggrieved party, that the respondent, when they got the relief they wanted, could properly bring a notice of related appeal. Don't we require that parties be aggrieved in order to do that?
The proper procedure.
Certainly they could argue that we could have affirmed in the last time on the grounds of 65B, right? That could have been an alternative argument. But it seems in order for us to conclude that it was waived because they didn't bring it up last time, we would have to then say that it's not enough to have that possibility as an alternative. They were required. Something required them to bring it up. And by failing to follow that requirement, that's the act or failure to act that now precludes their bringing it up today, right? So,
well, Your Honor, I don't mean to interrupt, but the goal of litigation is to narrow the issues down here. And if State Farm were acting in a way that they felt this was a valid defense, the appropriate position thing would have been to, as the case law says, raise the issue before the district court on after it decided on reconsideration and say, we have this alternative basis that we think it should be addressed by this court so we can take it up to the Court of Appeals if you are disagreeing with us and the Court of Appeals can address both issues at the same time.
But
We're not trying to do piecemeal litigation.
Is there a disagreement about best practices, or is there some requirement that they do that? I understand what you're saying about the goal of litigation, but that sounds like a best practices argument rather than a requirement.
I can't say it's a requirement, Your Honor. I can't say there's case law that indicates it should be done, and it's cited in our brief. And it's certainly going to make litigation more efficient if parties are required to bring all of their claims in one to this court in one instance.
Is it safe to say, Mr. Gillespie, once our court remanded, the district court certainly believed that State Farm was relying on that defense? I recall the quote. I don't have it right in front of me because I'm looking at the order that we're actually reviewing today, the earlier order denying, where the court made the statement that State Farm was relying almost entirely in its defense on 65B and opposing summary judgment. And then when I look at the order we are reviewing, it looks as if the court felt that it could not rule on that issue, similar to the argument you're making today. In fact, the court on page 4 of its memorandum, this court now has the impression that pursuant to Minnesota Statute 65B.57C, plaintiff did not have a valid lien, but then goes on to explain why the court felt it could not. And so would it be fair to say the court had it before it, but again didn't address the issue because it didn't believe that it could, so it's never been addressed? So the point, I guess my question is, if we disagree with you that State Farm's not precluded and therefore it's before the court, it's not yet been decided.
It's not yet been decided, Your Honor. I'll agree with that. It's never been fully even briefed, to be honest with you, Your Honor. And it's never even been resolved in terms of is there even the statute being applicable. That's why it would be inappropriate for this court to reach out to try to decide whether the statute applies or not in this particular instance, because you don't have any briefings.
And would you agree that whether it's applicable is a question of law?
It's a mixed question of law and fact. The statute requires first a denial. The record here is that State Farm sent off four letters over a period of 6 months, each time saying, we're investigating your claim. Doesn't say what they're doing, just basically, we're investigating. And the exact same language is in all four letters. Is that a real denial? Are they really investigating? The record indicates that when we sought to depose the people who wrote those letters, State Farm objected and tried to prevent those depositions, so we could determine if indeed they were actually doing anything or was just as a pretext to stall. So there's a huge factual issue as to whether there ever was a denial or not, actually a constructive denial or not. There never is never a...
It wouldn't make much sense then for State Farm to have revived summary judgment on 65B grounds, given what you're calling a huge factual issue.
Not even when they say there's a factual issue with regard
to whether it was
denial.
I understand that. I heard Mr. Roll say those same things.
Yeah.
So that's why it makes sense that they wouldn't have brought a motion for summary judgment on remand under 65B, that they would simply oppose a motion for summary judgment from plaintiffs on that same basis. They wouldn't have brought their own because both sides seem to agree there's a fact issue for a jury.
Right, but for them, before in the first appeal, they should have raised the 65B issue.
Didn't they raise it in the summary judgment motion?
In the second summary, in response to our summary judgment motion, they did.
Okay, so
they
claimed
they raised it in their in the first summary judgment motion that was appealed successfully by the law firm, and was reversed by this court. They claim they raised it, and the court does note in its opinion that they raised it in their first one, but I don't believe it was addressed in that one.
It wasn't addressed by the court, but they did raise that as part of the summary judgment response.
In the first one.
Correct. And,
yes.
And then later, with respect to the motion to compel discovery, I believe they raised 65B as well in that?
Well, I mean, their objection to discovery was that they claimed that discovery ended during the time of the first, before the remand and before the first appeal. They never made a request, ever, after remand for any discovery. They didn't request the depositions of any of the affiants.
But didn't in their motion for reconsideration, didn't they also raise 65B as an issue as well?
They probably did in their motion for reconsideration, but they didn't raise the fact that they were sandbagged or didn't have adequate time to prepare to defend. If I could
ask a question about that too. So if I'm trying to make sure I understand the sequence, all right? On remand, then there's a motion for summary judgment that gets denied, as the district court says, almost entirely because of 65B. Right? So
correct.
They think they're going to trial. And it's not until the eve of trial that there's this curveball and a reconsideration of the previous denial. So what sense does it make to say that they should have asked for discovery or asked for a deposition once their opposition on 65B grounds was persuaded the district court? They're just waiting for trial. They'll do that cross-examination at trial.
But the record reflects that they did see it as a factual issue. And they saw whether
right.
the intent was going to be a factual issue. And, I mean, they can certainly say to the district court, give us a shot at cross-examination. We're all Perry Masons here. We could win this thing on cross-examination. But there's no basis in the law to deny motion for summary judgment merely because I can score on cross-examination, and therefore...
But my question is about the discovery piece, the failure to ask for a deposition of that affiant. I don't know how I can infer from that or how I can hold that against State Farm when they were... Maybe they believed they were all Perry Masons and that at the trial they would be able to call into question the credibility of that affiant, and they didn't need a deposition ahead of time to lock that affiant into certain answers, right? It seems like that the argument is that you're making is that they should have asked for deposition. They should have done some discovery, and the fact that they didn't now somehow closes the door, to use that analogy again, on this process problem that they're asserting now.
Yes, because they're claiming they were sandbagged. They didn't have adequate opportunity to defend the motion. And I'm saying they didn't avail themselves of any of the opportunity they had to defend the motion.
And my question for you is, why would they be required to avail themselves of discovery when they're planning to do that cross-examination at trial?
Because the party owes the court more when looking at a summary judgment motion than just a promise that I can score on cross-examination.
Mr. Gillespie, I'm going to posit a slightly different scenario, but it's all have the same topic because I, too, want to kind of understand the sequence. The first time, post-remand, the judge denies summary judgment and does, as Judge Bryan pointed out, relies heavily on 65B and essentially agrees with what you are both saying today, that there's fact issues, and that would be an appropriate basis to deny summary judgment. She then reconsiders that decision somewhat sua sponte, but on the same evidence, but on the basis that she cannot, the State Farm can no longer rely on 65B. So is not the point of all of this discussion really nothing to do with sandbagging or any of that? And there's even a concession today by State Farm that if you took that out, there is no genuine issue of material fact. But if we put it back in, that would be the issue for trial, correct?
The issue for trial, at least according to State Farm, was number one, what was the intent of the parties? Was the payment here within the scope of the representation of a law firm? And number two, was there a denial by State Farm of benefits?
But it's the latter that would be the 65B. That'd be the only thing on the table now for a fact issue if we were to remand, and that's including State Farm's concession today. So there's nothing to do with the attorney lien statute anymore, simply whether there's a exception and or slash defense, however you want to call it, and whether there's been a denial.
The denial is the first step, Your Honor. If there's a denial, then we have to decide how the statute's interplay of the statute applies. I mean, because one statute then would be effectively nullifying another statute, which is not an appropriate thing to do. So this court would have to then balance which statute applies in this particular instance. And so we're
You're saying today you're not sure whether or not 65B, the language of that statute, in your words, nullifies 481.
I think there's an argument that 481 would survive no matter what 65B says. I'm not saying the court would accept that argument.
Why don't you give me that argument? You have a few seconds left, but I am interested to hear that legal argument because it seems if we disagreed or whatever. Why don't you give me the argument?
All right, I wasn't really prepared for this, but I'll give it to you off the seat of my pants, Your Honor. We're looking at construing two statutes, and we have to do it some way that they both can survive within the realm that they are entitled to survive in. And both have effect within the time that they're survived in. And does one statute nullify another statute in some instances? And what are the rules about that as far as if the legislature passes this statute and this statute later, does that mean this one nullifies that one in part? Or is the other way around? There are a number of statutory rules of construction that would come into play if we're going to decide whether Chapter 481 is somehow nullified or somehow affected by 65B.57.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question.
I'm out of time, Your Honor, but I'll keep going.
Right, but since I'm presiding, I can do that.
Thank you.
I just want to follow up on that. And I realize we're getting into an area that wasn't mm-hmm. necessarily extensively brief, but isn't 65B really an exception to 481? Can't they be read
That would be an argument, Your Honor, yes. I mean, the court could rule that way. I mean, there are a number of ways the court could rule when it was fully briefed on the issue and had all the law in front of it. It could say there's an exception. It could say that they're separate. It could say one is a repeal of another one. But you don't have any of that in front of you right now. There's absolutely nothing in front of you right now as far as how those two statutes interplay. And so it would be completely inappropriate, number one, to rule on it from this point on. And given the fact that we would like, at some point, all litigation to come to an end, we should impose on State Farm the obligation to have brought this up to the court the last time we were here instead of standing on their victory and not bringing up what they thought was a fair defense.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your arguments. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Would you like me to address that question that you just asked about how the statutes would interplay?
Actually, that'd be great if you could.
Sure. And that was kind of the basis of how I structured my original brief. But the Minnesota statute 481.13, the attorney's lien statute, specifically says that an attorney has a lien based upon the cause of action from the time of service and summons in the action, and number two, the second part of that statute is upon the interest of the attorney's client in any money or property involved or affected by any action or proceeding in which the attorney may have been employed from the commencement of the action. In this matter, in a no-fault matter, the claimant doesn't have any interest in the money or the medical bills. That goes to the medical provider. And so these statutes don't actually conflict because generally in a lawsuit, the plaintiff's client has an interest in the money. In this matter, they don't. It's the chiropractor's money. And so, yes, Mr. Gillespie did establish a lien, but it wasn't over any money that was at issue in a no-fault matter because the client never had any interest in that, and we know that because of 65B57, which says that nobody can have any legal interest, regardless of lien, contract, anything, until the claim has been denied. And the claim hasn't been denied, and there hasn't been any argument or evidence that it's been denied. And so 65B57 doesn't conflict with the attorney's lien statute, because in this case, Mr. Gillespie's client never had any interest in the money or property. And then I just want to close by saying that the respondent in this matter agrees that material issues of fact exist. They have agreed that State Farm did raise this argument at the district court level, and they've agreed that the judge never considered the matter. And so I would ask that you reverse the district court's decision based upon that information. Thank you.
One final question. Are you arguing that it should just be outright reversed or reverse and remand for reconsideration by the district court on the issue of the denial in particular 481 and 65B?
Well, the district court has opined that if the issue was raised at the district court level originally, then the plaintiff wouldn't have a valid lien. And so I think the district court's already made that decision, but if you guys think that it would be appropriate for you to make it, then that would be great.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your argument and briefing. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you.